Support for WSIU's In the Author's Voice is provided in part by listeners like you. To make your donation, log on to WSIU.org or call 800-745-9748. Thank you.
Castro's Daughter is a book that's been in the works for me for 30-some years. I'll put this in a nutshell. I was doing a book back in the late 70s, early 80s. I wondered what would happen if the Russians tried to sabotage our first atomic bomb test down in New Mexico. And so I was able to get down there, and the government let me, you know, in the area, in the desert, and I had a range officer with me for 12 hours. And at one point, we're sitting on the bed of his pickup truck and drinking a beer. And it was 5% humidity and 100 degrees, and this was in the fall. And he said, "What do you know about the Jornada del Muerto, the Journey of Death?" I said, "Never heard of it." "What do you know about the legend of the gold in San Vittorio Mountain?" I said, "Never heard of that either." He said, "How about the seven cities of gold, Cibola?" And I said, "I've heard about that." He said, "Well, it turns out that the Spanish, when they came to this hemisphere, they plundered gold and silver all over the Caribbean and Central America and South America, brought it up to Mexico City, and shipped most of it back to Spain via Havana, Cuba. Well, the church wanted a part of this, and so a group of monks from Mexico City, this is all real or urban legend, between real and urban legend, they packed several hundred tons of gold and silver aboard muleback and brought it north through Mexico into what's now southern New Mexico, where they hid it in seven caches, so the seven cities gold, Cibola. Back in the 30s, a deer hunter may have stumbled across it because he brought out a couple of gold bars, which are of that era, but then he disappeared. But here we're getting closer to the start of the story. In the 50s, Fidel Castro, with Che Guevara and the Russian advisors, were in Mexico City planning the Cuban Revolution. There was one of the hangers-on was this young guy, just got his PhD in archaeology, a Mexican. And he told Castro and those guys, he said, "Look, I know where I can get my hands on several $1 billion to help finance the revolution." Nobody believed him except Fidel Castro. He put it in his diary. Now we're present day, or maybe near future. Fidel Castro's on his deathbed. He has a couple of illegitimate daughters. One of them is a colonel in the intelligence service, the Cuban intelligence service. He's never acknowledged her, but he's pulled strings for her. He calls her to his deathbed and tells her about the gold and the seven cities of gold and all this stuff. And he said, "I want you to call Kirk McGarvey." He was ex-CIA, and he's been in a lot of my books. "He'll help you find this. Part of that money should go to help the Cuban people who are starving." And she said, "Daddy, you're crazy. His ex-CIA is not going to help us." But he dies, and she does her thing. And there's kidnappings and shoot-em-ups. There's Mexican drug cartels. Everybody's interested in a piece of the pie. Spanish intelligence service. And the fun part is, and this is one of the funnest books I've ever had to read. The fun part of this book, and somebody nailed me on it the other day. I was doing a book signing at a Barnes & Noble. They said, "Why don't you tell people about the endings, plural?" Well, the book seems to be ending, and the good guys win, and the bad guys get their comeuppance, and everything's solved, but there's 40 pages left in the book. And that was kind of fun. So they go through another evolution of stuff in another part of the country. And at the very end, you think it's over with, but on the last page, there's this one little thing that's never solved, which opens it up to a sequel, which I'm working on right now. But this was that's about as nut of a nutshell as I can put it in. And this was a great, fun book.
You know, I think a lot of people are, even if they're not necessarily treasure hunters, maybe they look at this from a historical perspective and kind of a what if.
Yeah, because what happened is that Columbus, when he got here, he brought three things with him. One was syphilis, one was smallpox, which killed a lot of people. And the third, the worst of all, he found some gold, little gold trinkets on a couple of the natives. And so the gold fever was on, and that was the big rush. The Cortez and the Aztecs, and De Soto was here in Florida. Was looking for the seven cities of gold, Cibola, and his men, he died along the Mississippi River, but his men made it all the way back to Mexico City, still searching and never found it. And so there's this, and there's been movies made of it, but I think as close as I could to tell and research and all that, there's a real shot that this could be down in New Mexico somewhere. That's the good part. The bad part is that's all on military reservations, Holloman Air Force Base and place like that down there. Holloman is where they're doing controlling all the drones, the drone aircraft that are like in Afghanistan and all that. So you can, as a civilian, you couldn't just go poking around out in the desert, which is kind of interesting.
That kind of leads me to the next question that I had for you. How do you research something like this, and how do you kind of pull fact and fiction together for a story like this?
Well, the first part of the research is I was doing this atomic bomb thing, and my publisher got for me permission to go on the test range, and they decided an Air Force officer with me, and we went all where the bomb, actual ground zero where the bomb was exploded, and then the remains of a village. And so that started, and then he told me about the San Vittorio Mountain. And Doug Preston is a big best-selling author. He worked for, I think it was the New Mexico Historical Society or something. He wrote a couple articles about the legend. And so there's a lot of material on. There's a lot of material in the Spanish archives in Sevilla, and you just pick up bits and pieces. But this is fiction, so you know I kind of weave this stuff and put a little spin on some of it and make it more real than maybe it is. You know, I don't know. Except the Vittorio Mountain where this deer hunter found this gold once upon a time. That's on an Air Force base. And the legend was, or the story is, that right after F. Lee Bailey was and his group were looking around down there, that a bunch of several Air Force trucks and excavating equipment were seen in and out of that area and for just a day and a half, and then they were gone and never came back. So, you know, the story goes, they went, knew the gold was there. They dug it all out, trucked it off to wherever. And so who knows? But the speculation is just it's titillating. It's fun. It's like going down to the Titanic or that outfit in Florida found that ship filled with silver, and Spain sued to get it back and did get it back. So there's treasure out there. There's a lot of it out there.
I wonder how much of your inspiration comes from your work with the Air Force, or is it completely separate?
No, it's pretty much the same. I was talking to a group of beginning writers the other day, too, and we're talking about my background and my motivation. And I used Hemingway as an example because he was my god when I was a kid, when I was learning how to write. When he lived in Paris in the 20s for a few years, it was just it made an indelible impression on all the people he met, Ezra Pound, Cummings, all those guys. And when he left Paris, he always called, he did a nonfiction book, he called that time in Paris his movable feast, because thereafter, whenever he wrote, he would feast or draw from that era in his life. So I spent 7.5 years in the Air Force as a cryptographer in northern Greenland, 700 miles from the North Pole, and 3 years in Germany. We built the largest crypto center in the world in what had been an old Nazi bunker. That had been 1962 and 63. And I got to run around with some guys from the CIA and the National Security Agency, and they sort of, you know, adopted me, sort of. And that 7.5 years, that's my movable feast. And so, you know, this kind of intrigue, and I still know guys who work for the CIA. They don't give me secrets, obviously. I know some of them who are retired, and we talk, and they'll call and say, "Hagberg, you bonehead, it's not that way, it's this way." And I say, "Okay, thanks for the heads up." And they send me stuff on weapons, and so I'm still drawing from that after all these years.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times that as much as you do the research and as much as there is some basis in fact, this is fiction. Are your characters based on anyone you know, or is there any element of you in any of the characters?
Yeah, most successful writers of fiction learn a trick early on that every character, man, woman, and child in their novels are partly them, in a large part them, and you blend in with other people you've known well, like some of the women characters in my books are a cross between my wife and my youngest daughter, are both very, very strong-willed women and very arrived and accomplished. Kirk McGarvey, my main character, the two things about Kirk is whenever he walks into a situation, everybody around suddenly calms down and says, all right, McGarvey's here, everything will work out okay. And that's my wife's brother. He doesn't know it after all these years because he doesn't read. He's not a reader, but that's Mark. That's him. Whenever, you know, the house could be burning down, the terrorists are attacking in the backyard, and your dog's biting you, Mark would walk in, and the fire goes out, the terrorists go away, and the dog is tame. Everything is, you don't have to say a word, just everything is calm. There's that something, charisma, whatever you want, and I'd pump that into Kirk McGarvey to great extent, I think.
I'm running short on time, but I wonder, is there any moral or is there any lesson you hope your readers get from these stories?
Yeah, I don't try to be preachy or moralistic, but early on in Kirk McGarvey's life, he's a real person to me. Early on in Kirk McGarvey's life, he happened upon some in his high school in Kansas, saw a bunch of big football players raping a young girl, obviously younger and helpless. And he beat the hell out of him. And ever since then, there's that one thing about McGarvey. If you're weak or if you're downtrodden or if all the odds are against you, he's sort of like the Caped Avenger or Superman or the Lone Ranger or something. He rides in and in to save the day. Not just the maiden, but the helpless maiden, but anybody who's in trouble and who needs help, McGarvey's right there and he figures it out. He doesn't play by the rules. There's any number of times they've wanted to put him in jail or charge him with treason, but he does things for his country that the CIA or the big organization can't. Don Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, said after 9/11, he said, all our nuclear weapons, all our submarines, all our jet fighters could not have prevented 9/11, all that power. It took something else. McGarvey would have prevented it.
Fair enough. With that, I'm out of time, but David, I sure appreciate you talking to me this morning.
Oh, thank you much. Have a good one.